welcome to Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute, where we offer a skeptical take on U.S. foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Trevor Thrall, a senior fellow at Cato.
And I'm Emma Ashford, a research fellow here at Cato.
Today we're back on the topic of the Iran nuclear deal, after Trump declined to certify Iranian compliance. Our guest is Colin Kahl, an associate professor of political science at Georgetown University and a former deputy assistant to the president and national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Let's start, as we always do, with some news review. First, in a break from its traditional role, the CIA is set to take on an expanded role in hunting and killing terrorists in Afghanistan. How's that looking for you guys?
Well, hi, Trevor. Thanks for having me on the program. In general, I think that the CIA's role as a paramilitary entity should be as limited as possible. I don't have any inside information other than what I'm reading in the newspapers. But if it's right that basically CIA counterterrorism units are partnering with contractors and Afghans to go after Taliban as opposed to al-Qaeda or Islamic State leadership, that would be a substantial expansion of the CIA's role inside Afghanistan, and probably in a way that would tax their resources considerably. In fact, one source of the leak might be those within the intelligence community who are concerned that this is an expansion of their mission in a way that would distract from higher value targets. I think if this is indicative of a broader trend towards us getting back into the counterinsurgency business in Afghanistan, that's a pretty slippery slope towards a much more expanded mission. I understand that the Trump administration's strategy ultimately is to put pressure on Taliban leadership to try to encourage them back to the negotiating table, and I get that. But I worry about making the CIA the pointy end of the spear on that one.
Yeah, it sort of seems like this might be Mike Pompeo's hand directing things, because he's said a number of times that he wants the agency to be more aggressive. And he's never quite specific about what that means. Does he mean more targeting, more operations? Does it mean this kind of more paramilitary stuff and a shift away from perhaps traditional espionage? And I think, again, from the point of view of the CIA itself, which had been perhaps shifting a little away from that counterterrorism mission and back towards its more traditional role of intelligence gathering with regard to other states, this would seem to sort of short-circuit that shift.
I also think that a terrorist is not a terrorist is not a terrorist. That is, that while it makes very much sense to focus our intelligence resources on elements of al-Qaeda leadership in the Islamic State, potentially elements of the Haqqani network that target American forces, that is, groups that either directly threaten Americans or threaten to commit attacks against the United States or citizens abroad, I get that. But if the articles are right that the CIA is getting into the Taliban hunting business, that's a dramatic expansion against actors that are a significant threat to governance and stability inside of Afghanistan, but not a direct threat on to the United States.
For me, looking at this from the broader historical sweep, if you look at the times when the CIA has gotten itself into trouble, hot water, it's been when it moved beyond the strictly intelligence role into paramilitary, into, you know, non-intelligence efforts of various kinds, all the way from, you know, just hunting bad guys to, I don't know, toppling governments and so on. And I just think it's safer for all of us if the CIA stays in its lanes, if you will. And I do agree with you, Emma, that this looks to me like it has Pompeo's sort of signature on it, because he's probably the most partisan person running the CIA in some time, maybe since somebody back in the Reagan administration, possibly. But to me, that's a bad combination of partisan person in that job. Okay, let's talk about Rex Tillerson. Tillerson's been traveling the Gulf, as well as Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India later this week. It's a whirlwind trip for him.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's important for Tillerson to get out there, especially to parts of the world that aren't getting as much attention. I think, you know, the trip to India is important. I've been a little troubled by some of the comments in the last few days on Iraq specifically. You know, he got himself in some trouble with some comments alongside the Saudi foreign minister talking about how Iranian-backed militia inside Iraq had to depart Iraq, only to be reminded by the prime minister of Iraq that these militia are actually Iraqis who live in Iraq, and that the Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization forces, many of them cooperate alongside the Iraqi security forces. Some of them are integrated into them. And while I think we should be very concerned about the role that some of the hardcore groups, especially groups like Kataib Hezbollah and Asayb al-Haq, those that are kind of wholly owned subsidiaries of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC Quds Force from Iran, these are Iraqis. And the best way to balance Iranian interests inside Iraq over the long term is to maintain a strategic partnership with Iraq. And the best way to compromise that is to do things and say things that put us at odds with Abadi's government in Iraq. So this was an own goal by Tillerson. It's probably recoverable, but completely unnecessary, especially at a time when the campaign against the Islamic State inside of Iraq is essentially culminating. There's only one stronghold left. It's along the border in a place called Al-Qaim. And as that campaign culminates, the natural friction points between us and Iran are going to go up inside Iraq. So this was, I think, something that he said perhaps gratuitously to impress his Saudi counterpart, but was not helpful to the politics inside Iraq.
Per Rex, he's always putting his foot in his mouth, I feel. And I don't know if that's just because he hasn't bothered staffing up the State Department, doesn't have good advice, or he's just not very good at this in general. But I will say one thing in his favor about this trip. He has gone to Saudi Arabia and he went to Qatar and he has addressed the Gulf crisis. And the line that he has actually taken on the Gulf crisis between those countries has been pretty reasonable. He's actually saying, well, look at this, look at the situation. It looks like the so-called anti-terror quartet, that's Saudi Arabia and its allies in this, are making very unreasonable demands. The Qataris seem to be willing to come to the table. And he's saying, well, it's up to the anti-terror quartet now to come to the table and negotiate with them. And this actually struck me as so unusual because it's something that you almost might see in a regular administration rather than this administration. But with Rex, who knows if he has the capacity or ability to try and solve the crisis that way.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think there are inherent limitations. First, he's not great at the job. And it doesn't appear like he's getting terribly better at it over time. Second, it's not clear he has top cover from the President of the United States, who regularly kneecaps him on issue after issue, North Korea being a prominent one. And then the third is, Emma, is a point you made, which is there's no bench. We're running this giant experiment of not having a government. We have a cabinet, although not even all of those positions are filled right now. And we have career civil servants who are denigrated as the deep state. And the entire middle of the government is pretty much absent. So even if, and the way that Tillerson is trying to compensate for that is to recreate a mini State Department on the seventh floor of the State Department in and around policy planning. But that's not how you run a government. So he's not a particularly effective Secretary of State, and he's not put in a good place by how his bureaucracy is being run or by his president to succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure why, if I'm one of these countries he's visiting, I take Rex Tillerson seriously because, he doesn't sound very well informed. And he and Trump aren't talking every day. You can't really believe him.
And if that's true for Tillerson, imagine what it is when we send an acting assistant secretary or an acting deputy assistant secretary or a chargé d'affaires who is acting as the ambassador there, who aren't political appointees, have no wasta with the West Wing, have no relationship to the president. So even if Tillerson can't be trusted to represent what the president actually believes, why would anybody believe any other representative of the United States?
Well, that's depressing. All right. Next topic, Japan. They're a good country, right? So Shinzo Abe's coalition government wins, handily in the recent elections. And Abe has been calling for not only tough responses to North Korean provocations, which I think he has very solid public support for his stance there. But he has also been calling for revision to the Japanese Constitution to loosen restrictions on Japan's self-defense forces, including being able to use them for various military actions outside the country. That's been obviously hugely controversial in Japan over decades, but the timing seems like it could be right. How's that going to work out?
Well, I think for one thing that should be said is I think that Abe has probably done better than any foreign leader in establishing a good working relationship with Trump. And he invested a lot in it early. Obviously, there was the meeting in New York during the transition, followed up by the meeting down in Mar-a-Lago. And I think he gets Trump in certain ways, and that relationship I think is solid, and Abe should be commended for how smartly I think he's played that card. I think what you're basically seeing in Japan, and you know, I'm not the world's greatest expert probably on this issue, but at least from my vantage point, you're seeing two things intersect. One is a legitimate threat that the Japanese perceive from North Korea, although the nature of North Korea's capabilities that have advanced are really more of a threat to the United States in the sense that they already had medium range and intermediate range ballistic missiles that could range Japan prior to the last 6 months. The thing that's really changed is their ability potentially to range the United States with city busting weapons. But nevertheless, the threat seems a lot higher. The other thing, though, is that I think Abe is capitalizing on that threat to try to push the narrative and the conversation inside Japan in a direction that he's long wanted, which is to revise and update the Japanese constitution to allow Japan to play a more assertive military role in the region and around the world. I mean, Japan already spends, you know, they're among the top spenders on the military in the world. They have, one of the world's top and most sophisticated militaries. They have more advanced aircraft in Japan than we have guarding the continental United States. I mean, they are a powerful military country, but they have certain inherent limitations as a consequence of their post-World War II constitution that Abe would like to revise. I think the danger in what he's pursuing is that in hugging Trump so closely and talking about reorienting Japan's military role in the region, it could actually create some tensions within the trilateral relationship between the United States, the Republic of Korea, that is South Korea, and Japan, because the Japanese and the South Koreans have a very complicated history, and Japanese militarism is seen quite negatively inside of South Korea. I also think that the South Koreans, who are much more nervous about Trump's saber rattling than Abe is, get nervous about Abe hugging Trump on the North Korea issue. And then the other wild card is how the Chinese will react in the event that Japan goes down the road of being more assertive militarily. So I get why Abe is doing what he's doing, and I actually think it makes sense for Japan to play a more assertive role as a global stakeholder and a responsible actor. But there's some risk here too.
Yeah, excellent points. Boy, that's about it for that. I agree with everything you said there. All right, surprise question of the day. So, Colin, we ask this of everyone, not just singling you out. What do you think is the most overhyped threat that people are talking about today facing the United States?
I actually think the most overhyped threat that the president talks about on a fairly regular basis is the threat posed by immigrants and refugees. I think you've actually just seen in the last couple of days that we're about to turn the spigot back on refugees, although the total caps, I suspect, will be lower than they were under the Obama administration, with some cosmetic changes in vetting. My guess is they're not all that significant. And I think that's in a recognition that refugees don't pose a meaningful threat to the United States. The same is true of immigrants. I think that you've seen a president who has demonized these individuals because they're easy scapegoats for threats that don't actually exist. There have been no deadly terrorist incidents perpetrated by immigrants or refugees from the countries that the president has targeted. And in fact, alienating us from those communities is probably more likely to generate risks of homegrown extremism, people taking action against the United States that are already here, and or not being able to work with communities who could otherwise provide law enforcement with tips on plots like that. So I think I don't think it's overhyped generically, but I think for the president and much of his base, the immigrant and refugee issue is overhyped in a way that has real negative consequences for actual human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. Our colleagues Alex Narosta and David Beer have written a lot about the lack of a threat from immigrants and refugees. So I'll vote with you on that one. All right, let's flip it around. What is a really serious threat that's not getting nearly enough play?
You know, this is going to be a little bit of a cop out because it's not like, you know, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post doesn't have the periodic articles about this. But I actually think that the landscape of our competition with with Iran in the Middle East is changing outside of, we're talking about outside the four corners of the nuclear deal, in particular in the border areas between Iraq and Syria. So much has been focused in the last couple of years, for understandable reasons, on destroying the caliphate, that is, destroying the Islamic State's territorial base from which they can threaten the integrity of Iraq, Syria, and launch attacks against the United States and the West. That campaign is essentially culminated. Mosul fell a few months ago. Raqqa fell just in the past week or so. They're really the only remaining strongholds for the Islamic State are near the Iraq-Syria border. So on the Iraq side, I mentioned earlier Al-Qaim, which is a traditional Sunni insurgent stronghold on the Iraqi side of the Syria, of the border in the mid-Euphrates River Valley. And then on the Syrian side, a stretch of towns going up from Abu Kamal on just on the other side of Al-Qaim up to Deir ez-Zor. And I say all of this because right as we speak, the same forces that we used to defeat the Islamic State in Raqqa, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a coalition of northern Syrian Kurds and Arab tribes, is engaged in a fight to retake areas around Deir ez-Zor. But the Assad regime, the Iranians, Hezbollah, and Russia are also focused on those same areas, and the friction points, the contact points between us and those forces are growing and growing at a time when geopolitical tensions remain strained with Russia and increasingly bad with Iran. So it's outside of the Iran nuclear deal, which I know we're going to talk about later, but I think is actually a hotbed or a potential flashpoint for conflict in which our forces could be targeted or killed by the axis of Assad and vice versa in a way that could spiral into conflict.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up now because that was something people, I think, seemed to be really concerned about like a year ago, year and a half ago after the Russians came in and there was talk about whether we could end up with some kind of Russian-US conflict over Syria. And then it just seems to have died down that people have stopped worrying about it. Yeah. But you're absolutely right that we are sort of approaching the point where those groups are, if not already in contact with one another, going to be very soon.
Well, and Emma, a really important point that I know you know, but for our listeners is that prior to this, we were largely fighting over parts of Syria that the axis of Assad didn't care very much about. That is areas in the north and east that were not regime strongholds, didn't have a lot of economic resources, relatively sparsely populated. The difference with Deir ez-Zor is that the regime has had an outpost there for the entire war surrounded by the Islamic State, and there's a lot of oil and natural gas. And it's also in proximity to the Iraqi border. So strategically, it matters for Assad to control it because of the economic because of the natural resources. And it matters for the Iranians to control it because they want access to the Iraqi border so that they can construct a logistical corridor that goes all the way from Iran through Iraq into Syria and then on to Lebanon. So I think we've entered the phase in the campaign where the last remaining terrain actually matters very much to both sides, and that's new.
Yeah. All right. Well, good pivot with that one to our main topic of the day, which is the Iran nuclear deal again. So let's just start with what I'm still a little bit puzzled by, which is what exactly does Trump think he's doing or getting by not certifying Iranian compliance? What's the strategy here?
Well, first of all, I'm not convinced that the entire decision was rooted in a strategy. The reporting suggests that it was rooted basically in a temper tantrum by the president of the United States, who hated the congressional requirement of every 90 days having to validate Obama's Iran deal. He just hated having to do it. He did it twice, and the second time he did it, he told his advisors, "I'm not doing this again," for no reason. It wasn't rooted in anything other than his belief that the deal was a bad deal, his political statements that it was a bad deal, and that his North Star, for his foreign policy appears to be just to be the anti-Obama, to tear down the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to move away from the Paris Agreement, and now the Iran deal was next. And so I think the decertification play was actually concocted by his advisors as a way to satisfy and address Trump's anger about the issue while not necessarily bringing the whole deal down. Now, as they've tried to rationalize the decertification, and as some folks around town at various think tanks who have promoted decertification have tried to rationalize it, they have, at least post hoc, created a strategic argument. And the strategic argument is that decertifying the Iran deal and handing the issue to Congress puts Iran and the international community on notice that the Iran deal is precarious and that the Americans might snap back all of the sanctions on Iran and also have effects on foreign companies in Europe and elsewhere as a way of generating leverage, pressure to force the Iranians and the international parties that we negotiated the Iran deal with back to the table to renegotiate or expand the deal to address issues that either weren't covered by the deal or weren't covered to the satisfaction of critics. So that's the strategy. Whether it'll actually work, I'm doubtful, and we can talk about that if you're interested. I think the next thing though to watch is exactly how Congress responds to this, because they basically have two choices at the moment. They have 60 days under this congressional legislation called INARA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act that was passed in the summer of 2015. If the president decertifies, which Trump did last week, they have 60 days to debate on expedited procedures whether to reimpose all of the nuclear-related sanctions that were suspended under the agreement. Given that Iran remains in technical compliance with the agreement, that's what the IAEA has said, that's what Trump's own senior officials have said, and that most Republicans grudgingly accept on Capitol Hill, I think it's highly unlikely that you'll see the Congress snap the sanctions back, because I think they understand that that in essence would put us in material breach of the agreement, not the Iranians. So if they don't do that, then the question will be, do they feel pressure to do something to strengthen the deal? And I think Senator Corker, who has let's just say a complicated relationship with Trump, is nevertheless working with Senator Cotton on draft legislation that I think they hope will be bipartisan, that is aimed at trying to at least in their terms, strengthen elements of the deal. But I think that a lot of deal proponents worry would be seen by Iran and the rest of the world as essentially unilaterally renegotiating it. So that's the period that we're at right now, and we'll have to see what Congress does.
Yeah, one of the more interesting things I think here is that you're right. I think that Trump didn't have any kind of strategy when he set out to do this. But what it's effectively being treated as is kind of the ability to just reopen the nuclear deal. And it's being presented as a, well, now we can renegotiate, relitigate parts of it that we weren't 100% happy with the first time around. And so you do see people like Bob Corker, who voted against it first time around, saying, well, maybe we could set up some congressional legislation that would make this a better deal, that would insert, you know, sunsets into the deal that would say if Iran made certain steps, which they're probably going to reach naturally in 8 to 10 years, then the sanctions will snap back on. And so this is kind of it's an interesting attempt to take an internationally negotiated treaty that was negotiated between six different parties, more than six actually, but the P5 plus one as the main parties, and to then reopen it through a political process inside Congress. So we're basically asking Congress, or Trump is asking Congress, to rewrite an international agreement and then somehow hope that the other parties are going to go along with it.
Yeah. So two things for me on that. One is, you know, asking Congress to step up and take the lead on foreign policy is a joke, given their history. That's just not what Congress tends to do. They meddle. They make things difficult, which I guess is their job. But leadership is not usually their forte. Sorry, now I've forgotten the other piece. And the second piece is that this really smacks of, instead of America first, America alone. Both Trump and the Republicans in Congress seem to feel or believe that it's only what the United States does that matters, that as if we could renegotiate international agreements by ourselves at our own pleasure. And so, you know, one of the sort of next questions for me that I'd like to get your guys' take on is how are the Iranians responding to this and the Europeans as well, because they've got opinions about this.
Yeah, I mean, well, the Iranians in some ways are enjoying this actually, because I mean, it's a really hard trick to construct a situation in which the Iranians, who are quite aggressive in violating international norms, can play the victim. And yet the Trump administration has figured out the one way to make sure that Washington is more isolated than Tehran and to generate as much global sympathy for the Iranians as possible by making it look like we're implementing the deal in bad faith. And this is, I think, part of the danger. I mean, obviously, that perception is locked in from the way the president has talked about this issue. You know, his speech last week was extraordinarily problematic. It was riddled with factual inaccuracies. It had haunting. It was haunted by certain ghosts of how the Iraq War was justified in 2002, 2003, in terms of hyping connections with al-Qaeda and talking about WMD issues that weren't there and invoking regime changes in all sorts of troubling ways. But I think Congress runs the risk of also now adding to America's isolation, that America first means America alone. And here's what I think the risk is, and this goes to Emma's point. Corker and Cotton are drafting legislation that, in their view, would address things that are inadequacies about the deal, either because the deal didn't deal with certain issues that they find troubling, like Iran's ballistic missile program, or that there are certain aspects of the deal, like constraints on civilian enrichment, the Iran civilian enrichment program, which could have dual use applications for producing the explosive fuel for a nuclear weapon, that some of those constraints start to weaken at year 10 of the deal, that is year, in 2025, or year 15 at the deal. And so they worry that under the deal, Iran could construct an industrial scale enrichment capability that would allow them potentially to make the fuel for nuclear weapons. Now, your listeners should know, Iran is never allowed to have nuclear weapons under their obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and under this agreement. And the intrusive verification procedures under the agreement never sunset and are forever. And the additional protocol, which allows the IAEA not only to go to declared facilities but undeclared ones, is a pretty big deal. In fact, no country in the history of the world has built a nuclear weapon while under the additional protocol. So, but nevertheless, people are dissatisfied with some of the sunset provisions. So what the legislation would do, at least the drafts that I've been told about, would establish a set of triggers that said if Iran crossed a number of technological thresholds and or if they didn't take certain steps on the ballistic missile front, that would automatically trigger the reimposition of nuclear-related sanctions. The problem is that that writes into law U.S. reapplying sanctions in the nuclear realm even if Iran is with 100% technically compliant with the existing deal, which will be viewed correctly by not only the Iranians but the rest of the international community as us unilaterally renegotiating the terms of this agreement. And that's a big problem. And I would invite your readers to kind of flip the script. And this speaks to the how Iran might react. Imagine if tomorrow you woke up to a big story in you know, the Wall Street Journal that basically said the supreme leader of Iran says that unless the United States leaves Syria and Iraq within the next 6 months, they will stop fulfilling their nuclear obligations under the agreement. Well, that imposes a new obligation on the United States and then says if we don't follow through with that negotiations, the Iranians will blow up the deal and violate their terms. How would we react to that? I think we would react to that as the Iranians fulfilling their obligations under the deal in bad faith, because the deal actually says all parties are obligated to committed to implementing it in good faith. So I worry very much that this is going to leave us standing alone because of how unreasonable this whole posture will seem to the rest of the world.
Yeah, the Trump administration's approach really does seem to be that if we kick up enough of a fuss, we can force everyone else to go along with us. And I think, you know, Trevor, you asked not just about the Iranians, but also about the Europeans. And something that has been very clear over the last couple of months, very strong statements from European ambassadors, very strong statements from leaders of key European states, is that they will not go along with this if Congress decides to snap back sanctions. They will not go along with this if the U.S. decides to add more sanctions on Iran. And so those states will probably make it very difficult for us to apply sanctions, which really raises sort of the question of whether what the Trump administration and its supporters are actually proposing here is plausible. Could they get a better deal? Probably not, because they can't do it alone.
Yeah, I mean, it's too late to get a better deal in that sense, I think. The time to get the deal was when you were negotiating it. Trying to do that now, it's a little bit hard to imagine how that works. One question that I'm still trying to answer is how much of the opposition to Trump's moves comes from a belief that the deal is going to work versus people who sort of think that the fact that Iran was willing to do the deal means they really don't want nuclear weapons anyway.
It's hard to say. Look, I think that it's fair to assume the worst of the Iranians on this score in the sense that not that they've necessarily irrevocably made the decision to get nuclear weapons, but that they have shown a propensity over the last quarter century to at least hedge their bets. That is, to at least put themselves in the technological position that if they were to determine that nuclear weapons were important to advance the regime's survival or the regime's objectives, that they could do that. And frankly, some of the shenanigans with North Korea probably reinforces that. So a lot of times, a lot of people have made the argument that us backing away from the Iran deal actually makes it harder for us to negotiate something with North Korea. I think that's exactly right, because the North Koreans will say, well, why would we believe anything that the administration, any commitments that they might make? But the reverse is also true, which is basically seeing that the North Koreans are so close to having a checkmate nuclear capability that would deter the United States, and how agitated that has made us, may reaffirm the Iranian belief that their only way actually to deal with the United States is not through some diplomatic arrangement that the United States won't uphold, but to get the ultimate weapon to be able to hold the American homeland at risk. So I worry about that reverse causality as well. I think one thing, and I just want to pick up something that Emma said, because it's super important, and she's exactly right, which is that if the notion is that you get a quote-unquote better deal, that means covering things not covered by the deal and or extending certain terms of the deal. I think what the Europeans have signaled is they're not going to renegotiate the deal. We know the Chinese and the Russians aren't either, and the Iranians aren't going to reopen the terms of the deal. The Europeans have said they might be open to discussing supplemental arrangements associated with it. That's good. But that requires a degree of international consensus, not a strategy that isolates us and not Iran. And here's the problem. You'll hear critics of the deal say, no, we can basically get anything we want. Look, if we do secondary sanctions on Iran's economy, every bank and firm and business around the world will have to make the decision. You either trade with the United States or you trade with Iran. We're a much bigger economy than the Iranians, so they'll choose not to trade with Iran. That is true of many firms and banks, but not all of them. And in the absence of political consensus, any sanctions regime like that will be extraordinarily leaky. And I would just, ask your listeners to think about what things were like in the 1990s when the United States had secondary sanctions on Iran on investments in Iran's energy sector, and the Europeans didn't agree with our policy and therefore ignored us. And the European Union, in fact, had blocking legislation preventing their companies from complying with it. They threatened retaliation if we sanctioned their businesses and banks. They threatened to take us to the WTO. In this case, you'd have us being at odds with the largest economies in the world. I mean, Iran's major oil purchasers are China, Japan, South Korea, and the Europeans. Are we willing to risk a trade war with the most important economies on the world with significant collateral effects on our own economy? So I think even if they go down this road, you're not going to get anywhere near the pressure we had in 2015. I think we got the best possible deal, my view, the best possible deal available given the pressure we had. But even if you don't agree with that, we're not going to get 150% of the current deal with less than 100% of the leverage that we had in 2015. It's just the laws of diplomatic physics don't allow that equation to hold.
So I guess the big question then is, does Congress understand that? What is Congress going to do? Because it very much seems like a lot of different options are still on the table here. You know, we've got the INARA legislation, which is basically a simple up or down 50-50 vote on whether they're going to reimpose the sanctions. We've got the possibility that they could basically reopen this legislation and add something else. They could remove the requirement that Trump decertify it every 90 days. They could add these sunset provisions, and that would require, I believe, 60 votes rather than the 50 that it calls for right now. But there are several options, and I guess ultimately Congress could also just decide not to do anything. So where do you think they're going to jump?
I mean, if past is prologue, they won't do anything because they can't agree on anything, let alone at the 60 vote threshold, which would be required to do anything more than just snapping back the sanctions. Look, I think that Senator Cardin on the Democratic side has been pretty clear, as have a number of other senior Democrats, that they're not going to sign on to any legislation that violates the JCPOA. And I think that the way in which the Corker-Cotton legislation, at least the drafts that I've been told about, I think would be widely viewed as a violation of the deal. And so I just don't think they're going to get nearly enough Democrats on a piece of legislation like that. I also think that the The Democrats are very attuned to the point that Trevor made about America first being America alone. And in particular, there's zero chance that we put more pressure on Iran in the absence of the Europeans being on our side. And so I think Dems are also likely to try to hold any piece of legislation to a European test. So it has to be 100% JCPOA compliant, and the Europeans at the very least can't be aggravated to the point of kind of going their own way as a consequence of that legislation. And I'm not sure that leaves a heck of a lot left. If Congress wants to take actions outside of the deal against their ballistic missiles, against the IRGC, against Hezbollah, they've already passed legislation in that domain. And frankly, the president has all the authorities that he needs to do that. So I feel like it's legitimate to have a bipartisan agreement about pushing back against Iran's non-nuclear actions. But Congress has already been very active in that space, including passing legislation tied to Russia sanctions just a couple months ago. And so I think it's just time for the president to get on with it. I mean, if the weird thing about this is that what everybody agrees on is that the deal didn't solve every problem because it wasn't meant to, and that Iran continues to be a troublesome actor in the region because they are. So that would argue that we shouldn't be focusing on the nuclear issue, which is actually contained and capped in the worst case for the next, 8 to 10 years, probably longer than that, and that we should be focusing on other things. And yet this whole decertification weirdness has ironically made us focus on the one part of the problem that's actually not a pressing problem.
And in addition to that, why Trump chose to do this during what is already an incredibly busy legislative agenda where he is pressed to make any achievement happen, and the Republicans in Congress are desperate to get anything major done, dropping this in their lap at the same time is a recipe for one or all things to fail. He could have just waited 6 months even.
Yes. That would have been a mature decision.
Well, I guess we know why he didn't do that then. Not to forecast too far into the foolish prediction zone, but does this make it more likely that Iran does eventually have to decide to get a nuclear weapon?
So a lot of it depends on whether you believe that the deal survives completely, whether the deal collapses, or whether it suffers a slow death. I think it's unlikely to completely collapse in the near term because I think for a while there's a consensus inside Iran that they're happy to see the Americans shoot themselves in the foot and alienate themselves from the rest of the international community. So I actually don't think the Iranians are just going to walk out unless Congress reimposes the nuclear-related sanctions, in which case it becomes politically untenable for the Iranians to stand in, or if we reimpose sectoral secondary sanctions for other reasons that are seen as effectively reimposing the nuclear sanctions. But before then, I think you're more likely to see the Iranians stick in. But I do think if the Trump administration continues not to be seen as advancing the deal in good faith, you will see an erosion of domestic political support among powerful factions inside Iran over time, which could lead the agreement to suffer a slow death. The other thing is, if you see the United States and Iran coming to military blows inside Syria or Iraq or in the Strait of Hormuz or elsewhere, you could see a security spiral that leaves the Iran deal in tatters as kind of collateral damage to that and may increase the incentive for the Iranians to move towards their own deterrent.
Yeah, and you know, I think this question about conflict is kind of an interesting one because we have seen Trump, make these statements where he's sort of seems to be trying to tie Al-Qaeda to Iran. I mean, there have been some ties there, but they're fairly slim. He seems to be trying to make this into more of a big thing. And as I think you noted earlier, Colin, there really are some overtones of 2002, 2003 here. And so the question is, if Congress doesn't do anything, what will Trump do? Will he follow through on these threats that he has made to nix the deal if Congress doesn't do anything? Will he consider military action against Iranian nuclear facilities, against Iranian military facilities? Or is that just outside the realm of possibility here?
It's a great question. I think that there is a general consensus within the administration that we need to have sharper elbows with the Iranians. But I don't think there's a desire to have an overt war. I think that a lot of the adults in the room, I think in particular Jim Mattis, Joe Dunford over at the Pentagon, understand that There are things that we could do inside of the Middle East that would put our forces in Iraq and Syria at grave risk. And so I think they're trying to manage it. So the question is, how do you hit the sweet spot of pushing back against the Iranians without you know, moving to the point of escalation? I will say, though, that your listeners have to be you know, aware that, you know, things could spiral out of control in ways that aren't well understood. And I'll give one example. In the summer of 2011, as we were withdrawing our forces from Iraq, we got a lot of folks killed as they were leaving their bases from Iranian-made rockets launched by Shia militia. At the time, two options were brought to President Obama about how to deal with this. One was to authorize our special operations forces to do unilateral raids against these rocket teams. And the other was to launch Tomahawk cruise missiles into munitions factories and training camps inside of Iran. The president ultimately decided on letting the special operations forces do their work inside Iraq. But it's worth noting that Jim Mattis, who at the time was the commander of CENTCOM, advocated option two, that is missile strikes into Iran. And the reason I say that is we don't really have the option of having our special operations forces go full unilateral inside Iraq, or because there aren't as many of them, and there are a lot more Shia militia, so that's not really an option. So I do worry things could go that way. And the other example I would use just briefly, and sorry to go on for so long, but in January of 2016, you'll remember we got almost a dozen sailors swept up near an Iranian island in the Persian Gulf, and by the IRGC Navy. Those sailors were returned within 24 hours without a shot fired because we had multiple channels of communication. I think Kerry called Zarif, you know, half a dozen times. We were able to basically use the channels that we had under the nuclear deal to make sure that this didn't spiral into a hostage crisis. I don't know anybody who believes that if a similar situation were to happen again tomorrow, if we get some guys killed or get some guys captured, that this is going to end well. I think it could – because we don't have those channels of communication. We don't have those trusts. There's a lot of animosity, a lot of conflicting interests. So I worry very much about the inadvertent side of this. So the good news is the adults in Trump's you know, cabinet are hawkish on Iran but probably don't want an overt war. The bad news is they're hawkish on Iran, and you could see all sorts of situations in which a war happens by accident or inadvertently.
That's a chilling anecdote and probably a good thing to leave our listeners with to contemplate between now and our next episode. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Power Problems, and thanks to Colin for joining us. I appreciate it. Before we sign off, just a quick event note. You can join us here at Cato on November 6th for How Do You Solve a Problem Like North Korea?, a conference featuring former New Mexico Governor and Ambassador Bill Richardson, Plowshares Fund President Joe Cerencioni, and many other experts. A big thanks to our producer, Jeff Geld. And if you liked the episode, please consider writing us a positive review on iTunes. You can connect with us on social media using the hashtag FPPowerProblems.